Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're getting into something called kisspeptin. You might have, heard the name around, maybe mentioned by people like Huberman, Rogan, Conover, perhaps. But what's the actual science saying underneath all the buzz? We're going to dive deep into the preclinical stuff today, the foundational research, really, trying to figure out what kisspeptin is all about and why it's got people talking without drowning you in, scientific jargon.
Exactly. We're not zeroing in on what those specific people said, but more on the actual preclinical studies, mostly in animal models, right? That's the base for everything we really know about this quite fascinating molecule. Think of it like checking the blueprints before we talk about the finished building.
Okay, right. So let's jump in. What is kisspeptin actually doing? The name sounds a bit romantic. Is that relevant?
Ha. It does have a catchy name, doesn't it? And well, in a way, it fits because it's absolutely central to reproduction. Preclinical studies have really pinned it down as a master switch for the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, the HPG axis.
The HPG axis. Okay.
Yeah.
The command center for reproduction stuff.
Pretty much, yeah. Your body's main control system for sexual development, function, all of that. And what's really key here is that kisspeptin acts right at the top. It's this high-level gatekeeper, such a small molecule having this massive effect on the whole reproductive cascade. It suggests it's a really critical control point, which also means problems with kisspeptin signaling could potentially cause pretty wide-ranging issues.
Okay, so it's pulling the strings. How does it actually, do that within this HPG command center?
Well, the research shows its main job is signaling the hypothalamus, another key brain area, to release something called gonadotropin-releasing hormone, GnRH.
GnRH.
Got it. And GnRH, that's like the conductor for the whole reproductive hormone orchestra. It tells other parts what to do.
Okay, so kisspeptin tells the hypothalamus, release GnRH, then what?
Right. Then GnRH travels down to the pituitary gland, another major control hub, and signals it to release two really vital hormones. Luteinizing hormone, LH, and follicle stimulating hormone, FSH.
LH and FSH. What are
Yeah.
those?
Yeah, super important. If GnRH is the conductor, LH and FSH are like the lead instruments. In males, LH is mostly about testosterone production. In females, it's crucial for the menstrual cycle, and FSH, that's key for sperm development in guys and egg maturation in women, the real fundamentals.
Right. So kisspeptin triggers GnRH. GnRH triggers LH and FSH. It's like a domino effect or a hormonal relay race. But how does kisspeptin actually work at the cell level? How does it pass that baton?
Ah, yeah, that's where it gets really cool, scientifically speaking. Preclinical studies found that kisspeptin works by latching onto a very specific docking site on these GnRH nerve cells. It's called KIS1R, sometimes called GPR54. Think of it like a specific key for a specific lock, only kisspeptin fits.
Okay, so the kisspeptin key goes into the KIS1R lock. What happens inside that GnRH nerve cell then?
When that binding happens, it sets off a whole cascade of messages inside the GnRH neuron. These are intracellular signaling pathways. Basically, once kisspeptin docks, it triggers a chain reaction inside the cell that flips the switch to make and release more GnRH.
Okay.
And actually, research in mice has gone even deeper. It looks like kisspeptins can directly affect the electrical behavior of these GnRH neurons. Imagine these nerve cells have tiny gates, ion channels, controlling their electricity. Kisspeptin can actually influence those gates.
Making them fire.
Exactly, making them more likely to fire off their signal, which is releasing GnRH. It causes depolarization.
Wow. So it's not just sending a message, it's directly flipping the electrical switch on those neurons. That sounds, well, really important. And I think I read somewhere this ties into puberty.
Oh, absolutely critical. The animal models are very clear on this. If you have an animal model where the gene for kisspeptin itself, the KIS1 gene, is messed up, or if the receptor KIS1R is faulty, those animals just don't go through puberty, period.
Really,
Yeah.
that's huge. No kisspeptin signaling, no puberty in those animals.
That's what the models show, yeah. It just underlines how completely essential this pathway is for sexual maturation. And what's even more striking, maybe, is that when scientists gave kisspeptin to animals before they were supposed to hit puberty,
Yeah.
It actually triggered the start of puberty.
Whoa. Okay, so it doesn't just permit puberty, it can actually kickstart it.
It appears so in those preclinical models. Very powerful, direct role. And, that obviously hints at potential ways to understand, maybe even treat things like delayed puberty in humans some way. Though, of course, that needs proper clinical trials.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, so it kickstarts puberty. We
Yeah.
talked about LH and FSH earlier. What happens to those hormones when kisspeptin levels go up?
Yeah, the Preclinical data is really, really consistent on this point. Across lots of different animal species, if you administer kisspeptin, you see a significant jump in both LH and FSH release. And importantly, it's dose dependent. More kisspeptin means a bigger surge in these hormones.
Dose dependent, okay.
The fact that you see this same pattern in, you know, mice, rats, sheep, monkeys, it strongly suggests it's a really fundamental, conserved biological mechanism.
So in animals, at least, it's like a reliable volume knob for these key reproductive hormones.
Yeah.
What about specific events like ovulation?
That's another interesting angle. Preclinical work, especially in rodents, has shown promise there too. Kisspeptin has actually been shown to induce ovulation in some of these animal models.
Induce ovulation.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which, you know, naturally makes people think about potential future uses in fertility treatments for humans. That's a very concrete potential application that resonates with people.
Definitely. That could be really significant for people struggling with fertility. But it sounds like kisspeptin might do more than just hormones. Something about behavior, sexual behavior.
You're right. Yeah. The picture is definitely getting broader. There's some really intriguing preclinical evidence suggesting kisspeptin might also be involved in regulating sexual behavior itself. What researchers found is that kisspeptin and its receptor Kis1R, they aren't just in the hormone control centers. They're also found in brain areas we know are linked to mating behavior and, like, sexual drive.
Huh. So it's not just the plumbing, the biological machinery, but maybe the motivation, too. The desire.
Seems like it could be. Animal studies have suggested that kisspeptin signaling can actually influence things like libido and sexual motivation. It points towards a more kind of integrated role for kisspeptin in the whole reproductive picture, you know, not just hormone release, maybe an evolutionary link connecting the drive to reproduce with the body's hormonal readiness.
That's quite a lead. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I also saw some newer stuff about metabolism. That seems kind of out of the blue.
Yeah, that's definitely a newer area of research, still emerging, but quite fascinating. Studies are starting to find kisspeptin and its receptor in tissues completely outside the reproductive system, which hints, you know, just hints at possible roles in other things, like maybe regulating appetite, food intake, or how the body handles sugar glucose homeostasis.
Wow, okay. That's broadening the scope quite a bit. How would metabolism link back to reproduction, though?
Well, if you think about it, reproduction is incredibly energy demanding, right?
Right. Yeah.
Ovulation, pregnancy, lactation, that all takes a lot of fuel. So these emerging findings maybe suggest kisspeptin could be part of a bigger network that connects our energy status. Do we have enough fuel with our ability to reproduce? It's a good reminder that these different body systems are often tied together in, well, surprisingly complex ways.
This is all really, really interesting.
Yeah.
But you keep stressing this is mostly preclinical animal models.
Mm.
What's the gap between these findings and, you know, actual human use?
That's such a crucial point to keep hammering home. Yeah, these preclinical studies, they give us a fantastic foundation, a biological blueprint. But getting from there to something that actually works safely and effectively in humans, that takes rigorous clinical trials. Animal models are essential first steps, but human biology has its own complexities. What works in a mouse doesn't always, you know, translate directly.
Makes total sense. Okay, so just to quickly circle back, kisspeptin itself. What is it, basically?
So it's a peptide, which just means it's a small chain of amino acids, like a tiny piece of protein. It's made from instructions in the Kis1 gene. The name's actually kind of a funny story involving Hershey, Pennsylvania, where it was discovered, but the function is the important part. This initial peptide gets chopped up into smaller, active bits, and the one called kisspeptin 54 is the one we know the most about. And its main factory is in the hypothalamus, and like we said, it's that key signal controlling the whole reproductive endocrine system.
And you said doctors and researchers are getting interested.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's growing excitement in the medical world about maybe developing therapies based on kisspeptin. For reproductive problems like hypothalamic amenorrhea, that's when periods stop because of issues in the hypothalamus, and also real interest in potentially boosting fertility in other situations too. But again, it's really important to stress, clinical trials are happening now to properly figure out safety and effectiveness in people.
Okay, so finally, let's loop back to those names we started with, Huberman, Rogan, Conover, the prep coach. When they talk about kisspeptin, how should we view that? Given everything we've just discussed about the preclinical side.
Right. Well, it's important to realize that when you hear discussions from them, it's almost certainly going to be based on the existing scientific literature. And that literature is heavily weighted towards the preclinical findings we've been talking about today. The animal studies, the basic mechanisms, Their content can be really useful for, you know, raising awareness, maybe offering interpretations of what the science might mean for potential benefits or risks.
But it's not their own lab work.
Exactly. It's crucial to understand they aren't reporting original preclinical trial results that they conducted themselves. If you want the nitty-gritty details of specific preclinical trials, you really need to go to the source, the peer-reviewed scientific papers and the proper databases.
Gotcha. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground in the preclinical world of kisspeptin. It's pretty clear it's a major player in reproduction, that key messenger in the HPG axis. We've seen how it triggers GnRH, then LH and FSH, how it's essential for puberty, its role in ovulation in animals, and even these potential links to sexual behavior and maybe even metabolism.
Yep. And the big takeaway is that today was all about that foundational preclinical work. It's the essential bedrock that lets us even start thinking about how kisspeptin might potentially be used in humans one day.
Right. So here's a final thought to chew on. Given how wide-ranging kisspeptin seems to be, even just in these animal studies, what else might it be doing? What other maybe totally unrelated body processes could this peptide be influencing? And what kind of unexpected things might future research turn up about how our bodies are wired? It really feels like the story of kisspeptin is still very much unfolding, and these preclinical chapters are just setting the stage.